Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from the Smart Material Collective, made by nerds, funded by the listeners.
Hello and welcome to Why You a Doctor Yet, the only podcast that uses science and tech to answer the questions that you actually have. Things like, why is the sky blue? What's up with trees? And why is the weather so terrible? It's sunny, then it's hailing, then it's snowing, and then it's back again. It's terrible. I don't like it. My skin is bad. I'm your host, Alex Lathridge. I'm a PhD student in blah, 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 biology, something, something. I'm very clever. Comedian, and I have no energy to think about how clever I am. I'm kidding. I hate myself. Today, I'm with Sahail Patel. Sahail is an amazing journalist. He makes brilliant stuff for the BBC, and he forgot to get toothpaste, so I brought him some toothpaste. There's a little baby toothpaste, so now he's brushing his teeth. And we are joined by two wonderful guests. Today, I have first a biologist. He knows your body like the back of your hand. He's a hypochondriac Tinder aficionado. They don't call him the Roomba of Revolution Hall for no reason. He really cleaned up. And he's the only guy who, I don't know, he'll meet you. Then he'll take your mum out for a nice brunch. Maybe you'll have a mimosa. Maybe you'll have some kale. Super into kale. That's the life he lives. And then come home, had a bit too much to drink. It's fine. Your mum goes up to bed. He sees your dad. Takes a handshake, and the handshake like is quite firm but quite nice. It lingers for a little bit, but you know, there's a moment, like a whisper that looks between their eyes and that. And so, you know, chats to your dad, sees where it goes, maybe takes your dad up to bed. They explore certain things, yeah? And he shows him when two become one, like souls melding and that. And your dad, you know, he learns that sexuality is a spectrum, and you know, he's quite happy with his new understanding. And then he goes back downstairs, he goes to your fridge, he opens it, he gets some milk, he makes himself a sandwich. And then he sees you, he looks in your eyes, he sits down at your table, and then he teaches you quadratic equations. Yes, Oz is back. Hey, Oz.
Hold on. Who the fuck were you talking about? And also, when did I become a guest on this podcast?
When you weren't here for 7 months.
That is my biggest question. Screw all the rest, because some of that might be true. But when did I become a guest on this podcast?
Yeah, you were out for 7 months. I'm sorry. We had to bring someone in.
I see how it is.
Yeah,
clarify all the rest that you said later.
All right, cool.
Most pressing point.
Yeah, so my week was actually a lot different and a lot more responsible. I wrote a lot of my thesis.
Shut up.
No, I did. I was looking at it, and I'm actually almost crying because I got some, like, my supervisor sent me back some comments, some things to change, and I was like, I can do this. And I looked at the comments, and I was like, this is filling with dread. So I started doing another chapter, and I almost finished the other chapter. And I was like, every day I'm gonna finish this day and send it off. I'm gonna finish this day and send it off. I haven't sent it off yet because
I mean, you just need comments. You just need to take them as light suggestions. Okay. I don't think you need to stick. That's how I deal with my science.
Okay, and that's everything from PhD corner today. We're not going to talk about that shit anymore.
I wasn't even talking about PhD.
Yeah, because people were like, oh my god, this is a PhD podcast. No, fuck that.
It's just PhD dread.
Ugh, fucking hell. Let's
climb back out of this hole.
So, Oz, what have you been up to this week?
I've been up to a lot. I've been trying to settle back into London.
Yeah.
I had a gig on Thursday in Reading. I went to see Company on Friday.
Sorry, what is Company?
It is a musical.
Oh, I thought you meant Friends. Company.
I mean, it's a musical about Friends, so it's nice. Yeah, you're right.
I love musicals, all of them.
Is that what you've been up to this week, Sahel? What have you been up to?
I've eaten.
Yeah, that's good. Good.
Multiple times.
Yeah.
And then I'm really fucked today, actually, because I went to Bristol.
Yeah.
And I've been self-esteeming for 2 days. Let me tell you, man, I'm too old for this shit.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you were working all... Wow.
No.
I have less pity for you now.
Oh, you know, I thought you said you were on a shoot. You told me you were shooting.
No. That's I paid someone to do the work I was supposed to do.
Should you be saying that on record? It's his business.
It's my business.
Well, his business is his business,
it's
Alex.
My business, shit. No. It's my IG Ig0.
Oh, okay. So it's okay then.
Yeah, it's okay then. It's fine.
So a journalist listening to this, you're like, oh man, we should hire Sahel. Nah, man, he's gonna...
It's called subcontracting.
Subcontracting.
That's what it's called. You don't know that subcontracting.
Is it legal? Yeah.
We will make it legal.
Probably. No, but legitimately, I booked all the 2 shoots over the weekend and I had to hire some guy to do it.
Yeah.
To do the shoots, which I was like, yo, this is quite sick because I've hired these guys to do this and I'm still making money. I was like, yo, I should do this more often.
I have so many questions.
As in, I pay them a certain amount, but then the client pays me an overall amount.
Uh-huh.
So I've paid them, let's say, 120. This way, I did nothing.
You could go on like a nice holiday if you did.
But imagine, right? I did that five. This is how business works, isn't it? You just
does it.
It's like I pay some guy to do his job, right? And then I earn money from that.
All right.
And then the difference between what I pay him and what I receive is my profit.
All right, well, we do actually have a really, really good guest today. We're joined by Alex Verfeger. Alex, please introduce yourself. Who are you? What do you do? And why have you decided to join us today?
My name is Alex. Obviously, Alex said that, my namesake. I'm generally so bad at like saying what I do or what I am. So I normally use this term that I'm a maker of stuff. Essentially, I work a lot on technology. Most of the time working with organizations to build like new products and new services. However, a lot of my work is really trying to be focused on like positive human interaction and leveraging emerging technology to sort of get to that sort of desired goal of a positive human interaction.
Oh, wow. See, that sounds like lots and lots of different things. And it sounds like, how do you have all the time to do all that like stuff? How did you get into this, more or less?
To be honest, I have no idea.
That's the perfect answer.
I always get asked that question. I think it was more like I wanted to get into tech because it pays well, innit? And I didn't have to wear suits. That's the honest truth. Like I didn't. And then I think it's like, yeah, you get in, you see the excitement, you see the fancy pay, and then over time you begin to. Well, for me, I know definitely that I went on this journey of maturity and being able to expand my mind. So I think after then it was like, okay, I'm kind of bored of this type of stuff. And I've always had this desire about the next step. What is the next step? What is that next thing? What is that next direction? Like I actually wanted to spend most of my time working in fashion tech. That was kind of like a goal. I was really interested in how like the physical and the digital worlds could sort of come together, especially that was like inspired by the Internet of Things and loads of like me spending time reading tons of sci-fi and getting sort of caught up in this sort of, in my own world type thing. And then I remember I was doing my master's and then someone was like to me, okay, why don't you look at the ethical implications of like the physical and digital worlds coming together? And I was like, ethics, that's so dead, you know, because it just sounded mad dead. I'll be honest, everyone, like it wasn't like I really got into this whole ethics space and was like, yeah, ethics. So
I like that.
Then I started like saying, okay, cool. I'm going to look into this ethical implications. I'm going to look into artificial intelligence. And it was like, okay, you know, I always say that artificial intelligence is like the least most understood, most overhyped technological breakthrough in modern times. Nobody understands it, but everybody talks about it. And so I decided to look at, okay, and at the time, bear in mind that I was actually in a fashion design school doing a master's, and I was like the only person here interested in technology. So it was like, okay, I'm going to write a thesis trying to leverage sort of, there's a thing called speculative design, speculative fiction. And a lot, there are like a number of designers who have like tried to use speculative fiction in terms of how they sort of shape what a potential future looks like, what a potential type of stuff. And I was really interested in those type of like ways of working. I felt a lot of it was very avant-garde and stuff you see in artist galleries, but I was really interested in how that could be sort of being used in like maybe a real world scale.
What is fashion tech? What kind of stuff does that mean?
So fashion tech is literally about, so like stuff like the materials and the textures, and how do you sort of create, like Google has this project with Levi called Project Jackal. I probably said it so bad, but they create a jacket which can essentially sort of heat you up. Like, so, you know, but trying to take that relationship that we have with our clothes to like another level or enhance them. There's an organization called Lumia, and it's created by Madison Maxey. She's in the States, a young, talented black woman who's doing like really amazing stuff. And their company there does a lot of fashion tech in terms of changing the ways how.
So is it like you're basically trying to make smart clothes?
Yeah, you're basically trying to make smart clothes. But that was one part of it. The other part as well, I was really interested in the retail experience of like how, like there's like brands like Burberry, Nike, that have been really big on like that sort of retail experience of like trying to merge the digital and physical worlds together. And I was really interested, I'm really interested in space and spatial design in terms of like, how do you make a space? Like, if you think of it, people go to Starbucks, it is a coffee shop, but it has so much other aspects to it. It can also be a social meeting place. Maybe we can't do a podcast in there because it'd be bad and noisy, but you have the ability to do stuff. In a retail store, it's very much you go and you buy stuff, get the fuck out of here. That's generally that type of approach. And what I was really interested in was like, can we make the retail store of the future more than just come and buy things and change that aspect of it? I was just really interested in like my dream was to work on random stuff and hope that it provokes some sort of conversation. So I was really interested in that provocative type approach of working, but you have to get paid. You have to pay your bills, isn't it? So it was like, how do you find a balance with trying to look at provocative ways of working, but also getting paid? So that's always been like an interesting thing for me, but yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, but interesting you're talking about meeting spaces, because like, let's say, for example, you know, you go to a vape shop.
Yeah,
that has a big community around it. It won't just be you just go to the vape shop just to buy your vape juice or whatever, but you go there and you interact and you engage with people, have discussions around it. So is that the kind of thing you meant?
Yeah. It's really like, it was really, because that was kind of based, I'm really interested in the concept of participatory design. And so that is sort of defined as you collaboratively designing a space or an environment with the people who will utilize that space. So during my master's, I wrote stuff on like urban regeneration and about how urban regeneration is very much suited to business needs rather than like the needs of the citizens. And how that, you know, councils, what they do is that they say, we're going to regenerate this particular area, let's do some public consultations. And I was really interested about doing more than that, but co-designing like an actual space with the people, and the people being an active participant in that sort of regeneration process. There's been some examples in like in Scandinavia with like architecture projects where they were regenerating this area, but it was like the whole space was basically co-designed by the citizens who live in the space. And the project's really interesting. Like I forgot what it's called.
There's one in London as well. It's called Build Up. But they work with kids,
yeah,
and they design spaces like architectures and stuff. But so, it's obviously small scale compared to that. But it's a good idea.
So you're saying you're just taking the behaviors of the typical like audience of that, say, retail experience, and you're creating an experience rather than just you're here to buy, I don't know, a shoe.
So
people, it's more like a hangout for people, right? Because they, aren't there some places where like airports typically do this, where they study the behaviors of passengers and they create the terminal to like suit that experience, right? So it's that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of a thing, but it's more like being a very, I think when you think of it, one of the things is that everything we have right now in this room is designed by somebody else. And it's very much like the microphones we're using, the you know, the clothes we're wearing is designed by someone else. And how design has always been done is that the power of who controls the experience is normally in a designer. And the designer designs the space and then people fit into that space, or you use this equipment, or if, you know, this podcast equipment now, like for example, Apple removing the headphones and saying to everybody, you gotta use AirPods, but it's like, okay, Apple, what happens to me if my AirPods die? And I need to listen to music, and like, what happens then? But that's very much a designer controlling the experience and you having to be forced to adapt to that experience. And what I was trying to do was, what I've always been interested in is reducing, is, how do I say, democratizing power. And basically getting the person who's, I'm going to utilize this space, let's share this power and let's create this space, which A, at the end of the day, you organization make your money, but we are in a space that we enjoy and that type of stuff. And it's kind of, you know, inspired by people like Foucault, where it's like power isn't neither good or bad, but it's hierarchized. And I was really, I've been always been interested in like democratizing hierarchy of power and trying to make that level grounds. I feel like I'm going in a tangent here, isn't it? But that's
so it's products. They're products that are tailored to the individual, almost.
Yeah,
right?
In a way. Yeah, I would say that. It's like, and so like I set up a company with three of my friends called Community, and our work is really about positive human interaction and emerging technology. But the most important things in our projects is this sort of co-design piece. So everything we build or everything we work on, we always say to an organization who's hired us, this doesn't work if we don't have the people who we're building for in the room, or they're not actively in the conversation. It isn't like we build it, put it in front of you, okay, look, we've built this new thing, here you go, take it. But it's more like from the beginning, we go spend time with the people who we're meant to be building for. If you give me a brief, how do we democratize podcast access for minorities? Okay, cool, I'm gonna go spend time with minorities who have something to say and try to understand their values, their attitudes about just generally them maybe expressing their viewpoint and feeling like they don't have a space to do so, or podcasting equipment is crazy expensive, or they don't know how to use Adobe Edition, for example. And there it's like, okay, we come back, we're like, we've got this thing. It's like, okay, let's ideate some stuff, involve them in the ideation process as well. Then we make stuff, and you know, we're very big on like making tangible things. Then we like concept test with them and shape that. But there's that sort of very throughout the whole process, very hyper collaborative, rather than like we are the designer, we've designed the space, we've built this technology, and you just have to deal with it, which is how most technology development is very much set up today. And we're trying to sort of change the aspect of how we build things and put things in the world, you know.
But like, so like how far, because that sounds like miles away from it being like an everyday experience, you know what I mean? Like how does it become mainstream? Because it just seems so expensive to do it on such a like an individual, almost like group wise basis, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so there's like things around, there's something called Kat Holmes, or Katie Holmes, I might be bad. If she hears this podcast, please forgive me for saying your name wrong. But she had this emphasis on inclusive design, which was sort of, when she was at Microsoft, she was the director of inclusive design at Microsoft. Now she's director of user experience design at Google. But she had this emphasis on that inclusive design, you normally solve for one, but extend to many. You know, when we work on projects, sometimes our projects are like 6 weeks long, sometimes they're like 2 weeks long. So you're always having to be like, can we, like for example, we worked with the BBC on a project about looking at the future of news, and that demographic essentially was more like people between the ages of one, I think it was like under 26, looking at how we can speak to different people on socio-economical class, also in terms of race as well. But one of the key things is that whatever we built needs to work for them, but it also needs to work for everybody else as well. So it wasn't like we were building something and it's like, this is only for 20 under 26, but it was like, we're targeting hair, but our solutions also needs to accommodate that 45-year-old middle-class individual who's probably got more understanding of a political topic than somebody who's like, I don't fucking care, I just want to know what's happening with Brexit. And so, but having that, because it's true, it is pretty expensive. That's the reason why maybe people don't do it, or in a project, these things get thrown out. But I think we've seen some of the news, we've seen some of the problematic things, you know, and I think it's very important for us to be able to advocate for this type of stuff. So it is still very niche, that's true. We've been quite fortunate to be able to like slowly grow and build a business and grow a sustainable business trying to focus on this niche areas. But I think the world that we're living in right now is sort of opening up opportunities, unfortunately. I'm kind of leveraging the negative opportunities in the world to do stuff, which is sad, but it's...
Yeah, but that's great.
It's pragmatic, isn't it? I mean, a lot you're talking about, I mean, it makes sense. It's like, if you're making something, you want the end user to reap the most benefits out of it. But you're right, like the designer holds the keys to experience. And unless they interact with people who are experiencing that, then you're right, it's difficult to kind of assume what they want. But yeah, I think it's a good idea.
And I think I just want to add one context as well. When I, and it's just in case anybody listens to this, when I use the word... just in case.
Would you fuck you? Fuck you guys.
Excellent.
And I'm fucking.
No shade.
Just
in case anyone listens. Where fuck you? Sahel, take him out.
That's because you know that's what happens when you don't have me in the room, Alex. Okay.
I'm gonna make it clear. No shade. Because
the shade has been thrown.
No, because obviously my girlfriend says that my delivery of words sometimes come across as shade, and so she said to me to she's spending a lot of time looking at drag culture in the UK, and she's like mentioned to me to say stuff like no shade. So I'm now mentioning stuff like no shade when my attention's. But I will start that sentence again. And it was more like for anyone listening to this podcast. In context, the designer can be anyone. Doesn't mean necessarily I'm a designer, but I'm saying a designer is as an individual organization who controls the space or organizes the things behind the experience. So that's kind of what I just want to put out there for context.
So like, I think it's quite interesting because like you were talking about your work in like the future of news and stuff and how you design it from like a user experience like perspective. And Sahel, like you make the news, not like you actually make, like you do terrible things. You facilitate the news being broadcast.
It's true. That is technically what I do.
So like, you know, from both angles, I guess, because you're making the content and Alex, you're like, you were looking in that project, I guess, at how you can deliver that content and stuff. So,
yeah. What's a design sprint? I really want to know that.
The design sprint was created by Google, the venture arm. So Google, the big technology company, has an investment arm that invests in crazy amount of technology companies across the world. And so their sort of Google venture design sprint was this whole concept of, one of the things about the tech industry, speed is like their most favorite thing. They always want to build things so super fast. And the design sprint was like, in 5 days, you have a problem on a Monday, but by the Friday, you would have had some sort of solution that you could test with people. And so that's what the whole concept of a design sprint is like. There's a book on it called Sprint, and it's like how to solve complex problems in 5 days.
Mm.
One of the challenges about those type of stuff is that it creates this commoditization that you can solve problems in 5 days. Mm. I honestly don't think problems can be solved in 5 days, but that is the narrative that's framed.
So you did one of these with the BBC, didn't you?
Yeah, much more longer one than 5 days. I just have to make that clear. And what we did, because one of the issues about that sprint process now is that the sprint process assumes that the organization has an understanding of the needs of the particular individual that they're trying to solve the problem for. You know, and so it doesn't have a, for us, we use that very big on people being a part of the experience. It was to, we had to implement, we had to change the way how the basically the book talks about stuff and create our own stuff. You know, it was like, you know, getting the, like doing interviews with people and getting them to understand, like, okay, if the BBC was a person, what do you see the BBC as? Just getting the values and attitudes on like stuff like about the BBC, but also understanding how they consume news. The brief was like, how do we get people to participate on understanding these better? Participate for me was like, I was like, whoa, who wants to really participate with the news? I think people just want to understand it more. But it's like trying to understand those things, you know, of would people, how do they understand the news? How are they currently consuming the news? And then it's like, you after that, you got all these insights, you begin to ideate on how the amazing content that the journalists and the BBC are doing, how do we maybe present that in a different way? So like we had a project called Perspectives, and what Perspectives was all about was one of the things that was said is that, you know, a particular news organization can, from what they said, they felt that the BBC probably told news in a very biased way. You know, I'm trying not to shade the BBC in this.
Hey, but, Sahel.
But, you know, well, but...
It's all matter of perspective, isn't it? Yeah, that's what it is.
It
yeah.
is perspective, that is true. Or some article, you know, like, you know, I might disagree with that, but that's a debate for another day. But, like, stuff like maybe how the BBC tell stories about knife crime.
Yeah.
Or, like, the Rinrush scandal and, you know, some... questionable stuff that happened there. So what we decided to do in this particular project was like the content we're going to use to like test these solutions are going to be about knife crime and the Windrush scandal, which, you know, is very touchy because these is at the time when all of these things were going on. And so one of the projects we did was, one of the things we did was called Perspectives. And Perspectives, it's like, I'm going to show it to the room at the same time why we're doing this. But Perspectives is all about, I'm just showing it to the room at the same time.
I'm impressed with the multitasking.
So I'm even impressed by my own multitasking. But Perspectives was like this particular type of stuff. So you have a BBC article.
Yeah.
You can read it in text, but you're able to read
video
content
with it. Yeah.
But one of the most important thing about it was that you were getting different perspectives. So you could get the victim of a knife crime who goes, look what happened. I've just been robbed by somebody with a knife. You had a gang member who was like, this is the reasons why I have a knife. The police chief also saying her comments about, like, you know, because, you know, one of the things was that when people talk about knife crime, people attribute knife crime happens because of this or because of that. So the police chief, Heron, her comments was pretty important. We had an anti-violence campaigner, Ocho, share his also thoughts around it. We had a professor of criminology also giving that sort of academic understanding of like knife crime. And also a drill music DJ who was to talk about how drill music doesn't contribute to knife crime. And all of these things are archival content that the BBC already had to sort of create this, but they were all scattered across different places. It was like the DJ content is probably something that's done in a one extra interview, but it was like, can we consolidate that, get somebody to read this article and to have a better perspective than a text-based article? You know, even one of the, everything I think in my head is that it's up to the BBC to choose what content they want to put out there. So they could put six pieces of content that all have a negative perspective, or it could be to the integrity of maybe that journalist to perhaps say, let's have a mixed view. But it opens up a debate, you know, there's this whole debate about right now about, like, should a white supremacist have the same platform to speak about their thoughts compared to somebody else? And that's been a recent debate that's happened on Twitter lately that I've seen. So it's like, how do you...
It's very topical. And I think one of the good points you make is at the BBC, the idea is that you create impartiality by having these perspective views. And do you know what? Working at the BBC, that's very true. Every output has a different slant because different people work on it. and ideas across the whole spectrum, you get impartiality, but does that actually work? Because who the fuck watches everything on the BBC? Sure. Trying to bring that shit together. Yeah. I think it's a good idea, man.
So, just going back to what you said, the content that would come through perspectives is still controlled by, say, whoever the news organisation has that content, right? So how then can you branch that out? Can you bring in other sources of content to give a more balanced view? Because otherwise you're always going to be caught in this loop, aren't you? Even though, as Suhail says, they, as an organization, like say the BBC, they can take perspectives from different branches of the organization. But if, say hypothetically, I didn't like an organization like the BBC, then I'm not still going to buy into that content because I'm still going to have my own biases, right? I'm going to be like, this is still the BBC, so it's like biased or whatever, or whatever other organization that I don't want to engage with. So how can you change that?
I mean, if we live in a world, say, where this platform is like completely out there, and say you were able to consolidate in the same like news story sources from like The Guardian, sources from The Sun, sources from BBC, ITV, Channel 4, like all of them together, like all the, not mainstream, but you know, mainstream air quotes, news organizations, how could you put that together without bias? Because, you know, whoever has control of like this whoever has control of perspectives, they've got to be independent and they've got to be impartial to put it all together. So if one news organization controls their perspectives output and another controls theirs, they're going to have bias. And even if you were trying to put them all together, whoever collates all the different sources, it's their bias and stuff.
I think one of the hardest things is that I don't think impartiality actually exists. I don't believe in that. Maybe
I agree. I wrote an article about this years ago saying impartiality doesn't exist.
I'd love to read it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I gave a talk recently on Friday. Alex was the MC for it, and I mentioned that I don't believe in the concept that we could remove bias. I think we acknowledge that we're all biased in our own ways. One of the things that I did write in a particular piece, which I see across me, was I mentioned the thing about there were weak biases and there were...
I like that you're looking at your own piece on Sahel's laptop. You're like, what did I write? Let me just...
No, I actually have it on my phone here. I actually opened up the article on my phone so I could say some of the sweet stuff that I wrote in that as well at the same time.
Yeah, don't like misquote yourself.
Don't misquote myself, yeah.
I wrote some good shit. Let me drop that.
But I mentioned the whole concept that there's like weak biases, like somebody say, like, oh, a spider, or like harmless bias, that's what I wrote here. Like things could be illustrated as a harmless bias, and then they are harmful biases. But I think the challenge is for us is to acknowledge our bias. I mean, like, look, we're biased. How do we limit the impact of our bias? I don't think removing is such a, let's remove bias. I don't believe that exactly can happen. If a behavior scientist was in the room, I think they would also agree with that.
Because you learn them over a long period of time, don't you? And then it's just like so hardwired into you don't even know that you have it.
You know, so it's like...
Perfect. It's not a perfect system. How do you inform people? Well, you can't inform everyone perfectly about everything, but it's trying to do the best you can in the fact we are human beings. We view the world within the prism of our sensibilities, which, you know, instills with us biases. But if we have, for example, peer review, if you have like an editor and an assistant editor, etc., and then we have a cohesive, you have a broad range of opinions overall, then you kind of get there. But it's like you can't remove bias.
Yeah, you can't.
It's there.
It goes back to the journalist. The journalist let's bring up an article. The journalist is the designer of that experience. You know, they choose what we're going to read and consume. But they also in their head say, okay, I think this would be more important to talk about than this particular topic, and then you might have a word limit as well. So it's like, how do you condense everything into a word limit to communicate a particular thing? It's like, even you know, as academics in the room here, we'll say, what's the difficult thing of trying to write a paper and consolidate it in a number of words? And you know, you've got to pick, you know, as much as academic papers tell you to be like unbiased or impartial in giving your thoughts, either way, like, I don't believe, like, I remember finding academic papers. I was praying that I could find academic papers that worked with my argument. Mm. It's like somebody had said something that I truly believe in. Mm. And then I was digging deep. I found, as I thank God, oh yeah, I'm going to use this. But like, so I think it's, yeah, mm. It's
just a bit of confirmation bias, yeah. though, isn't it?
See, what I love is you're there like, oh, this is a new idea. I know, I think I'm being a bit shifty, trying to find something that, you know, really, really like backs up what I'm thinking. And me and Oz are like, yeah, that's every minute of every day. Like.
That's our existence. Yeah, yeah, you current think, existence, yeah. You just defined it.
Like, I'm writing my PhD thesis right now. I'm there just like, okay, yeah, I see what you say there, but I'm going to take a small counter argument and I'm going to back it up with these 20 things that say what I want to say. Yeah. All right.
It's like flat earth, isn't it? It's
are you comparing?
Hey, don't compare us to flat earth.
Have you seen that? Have you seen that new documentary, Beyond the Curve?
No.
I recommend it. It's freaking good.
I don't think calling us, like, comparing us to flat earth is, as we're about to, like, finish our PhDs, is a helpful thing for you to say.
No, it's a good thing to say about flat earthers. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. Prick. Talked a bit about your work, looking at how you can take design and tech, bring them together and like make a better, I guess, public experience, make everything better, I guess, society-wise. One thing I'd be really interested in hearing from you about is like really more on that tech bias and like with your work in like AI and stuff, because you had that, you did your, was it your master's in like AI and ethics? And I like earlier that you said ethics is dead. I'm gonna take that, right? And when I start my like coup for world power, I'm just gonna put that on the front. Well, look, this guy with a master's in AI ethics says ethics is dead. So,
he studied it, so he knows.
Yeah, he knows.
So I actually did a master's in innovation, and don't ask me what that means, because we left that. I mean, all of us left that master's.
That's exactly what everybody's like. Yeah, when people ask me about my research, I'm like, this is what I do, but don't ask me about it because I have no clue.
I have no clue, but yeah. I did on innovation, and but it was really interesting that I decided to go around the ethical AI route. Like, I never woke up in the morning and ever said to myself, I'm gonna look at technology ethics. I just wanted to make money, I'm not even gonna lie to you. But I thought, okay, you know what, this is a worthy area to sort of explore. And then I came across a article by Julia Angwin, and she was at ProPublica at the time. ProPublica is an investigative journalistic news platform, and she had written a piece on machine bias, and I was like, okay. And what she was talking about was a particular sort of risk assessment software in the States that was sort of skirning out biased risk assessments against black people compared to white people who were also being sort of analysed in regards to that risk assessment software. And so one of the things was that people who, like a black person who had like a higher criminal, had a less criminal record, was seen as more high risk, where a white individual who had like a very seasoned criminal record was seen as quite low risk. And Ozzy and Alex will understand this, that you are an academic, you're writing a thesis, you see this amazing article that's really well done, but you know you can't cite, well, you can cite this, but you can't make your paper based on this investigative article because your thesis because somebody will say it's too journalistic. So I was like, this is how I felt, innit?
And Alex, why are you making it hot right now?
I'm
like,
I'm sorry.
I'm just gonna leave right now.
But
sure.
You know. So, and I was like, oh shit, this is sick, but we're gonna have to find more stuff. And you gotta see it, this AI ethics space is so new. Like, it's like a space that sort of kicked off in like 2016 or something like that. So you're writing a thesis and everything is, new things are happening every week. Like, somebody's contributing to the space every week. It was so hard. But I started like investigating, trying to understand, okay, how did this sort of risk assessment score, how were they making like judgment on these individuals? How were they creating algorithms that were making judgment on these individuals? And so what I decided to look at, they had this particular type of survey that they gave out to the participants. And the survey was touching on things like Have you been arrested before? How many of your friends have been arrested? Have you, has your parents divorced? Like, it was asking like questions which, it wasn't like.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Specifically asking you, are you black, are you white, are you you know, like this, are you that, but it was more like asking questions which sort of could be linked to particular sort of nuances of race and other particular demographical information. And so it was like a survey, and you know, most of us know how surveys are already biased by design in the first place, and that was a bit problematic for me. And so I looked back at like his history, you know, in the 70s, you know, in the criminal justice system, did use race and other demographical information to sort of sentence someone until someone said, whoa, it's a bit problematic. You did have like the former Attorney General of the United States who also mentioned and referred that a lot of our risk assessment scores may be particularly biased. And so, you know, where the bias comes in is that you look at the way we train the algorithm, you know, you train it with data sets. What's the challenge of things about particular data sets? I don't know if Alex Neck is getting hot there, but but you know, it's like what I'd be interested to know what data set, because one of the challenging things about the organization who built the software is that they didn't want to open up what their like how this algorithm basically
was trained.
Is it a compass when you're talking about?
Yeah, compass. Yeah, so they're called North Point. That's the name of the company.
So where was this used? Was it just used with people who are like? Who had committed crimes when they're arrested, or was this just survey given out to general people? Like, how did it work?
So it was when you get arrested in a court case. So I think even in one of the pieces, I talked about how it was used in the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. Oh my God, I said that so bad. But it was used in a particular sort of state, like a very, this is like, I think it was like, this was like the first major sort of like where it was ever used in the Supreme Court. And I think the person who got sentenced was trying to, I think he was trying to make an appeal. I don't actually remember, but the Supreme Court basically made some references saying, look, don't use this. This software's purpose is to be an assistive tool, rather to be this tool that sort of determines your direction and you should make stuff. And I think when you think of how AI is marketed, a lot of the times it's marketed as this fully intelligent thing, and it's this smartest thing in the world. You're missing out if you're not using it. Where in reality, it's just sophisticated algorithms, you know. And one of the things that the Supreme Court mentioned was that, this is where it comes back to the whole transparency conversation, is that, and something like the criminal, you know, justice system is, that's like, you know, a very important thing. And it's like, if you're not being transparent about how it makes judgment, how are we able to critique it? Mm. How is someone being able to challenge, you know, that, how, you know, how is someone able to challenge that sort of assessment and say, this is wrong? However, when it comes back to bias, this is kind of perhaps reflective of how things are today. You know, as a black man, 6 foot three, or 6'4", sorry, beard.
I like that you jumped up from 6 foot to 6 foot. Like you have to. Anything above 6 foot, and you're like, oh, man, I'm just going to add a little bit more.
Nah, I'm 6 foot.
No question.
And I look intimidating before people have ever met me, you know, and seeing that, if someone's to do a risk assessment on me already, just by my looks alone, they might go, whoa.
Yeah, I get you.
You know. But, and if you, you know, so these things are sort of become reflective in terms of the, you know, the data sets we generate, the things, the algorithms we train, and then the software we build. And then we put into a system that is already probably problematic in the first place, and it just over amplifies things already. And so what people try to do is, let's reduce bias by coding out the bias, but I'm like, we can't.
So like, isn't this the biggest criticism of all AI like stuff that keeps coming out, like AI that's predicting, you know, like homosexual faces, AI that's predicting criminal faces, is that you're just teaching it the bias that you already had. So you're not really, you're not, you know, if anything, you're coding in that bias because of the data sets you're using. So do you think we're ever going to be able to genuinely code that out and have unbiased AI?
I think you have to generate new data sets. I think, like, there was a thing and I'm around people who do a lot of stuff, you're a biologist. So, like, there was an example of how AI's being used to detect skin diseases in people, but it couldn't do it in darker skin.
Right.
And what's that? There's perhaps a lack of data sets for individuals with darker skin that, you know, and so people's, let's say this hospital's got this, we've got this new sophisticated AI system that should be able to detect things, blah, 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 blah. You know, an Asian man goes to go get a check on skin. Okay, no, you're fine, but you're probably not fine. Mm. But, you know, so that's the dangers of those type of stuff. And it's like, okay, for someone like me, my head is like, those data sets, we have to generate new data sets, you know. If that means we need to basically sit down with, or, you know, how do we generate these data sets? Probably be an expensive process, but it's important for us to do so, because I think, yeah, that's like my, like the whole AI being able to gaydar thing. Like, it's so, like, I don't even understand how they've tried to basically train an algorithm to sort of say, okay, you know, this person's most likely to be gay.
I mean, it takes exactly what you said, I think. Yeah. If you look at that research that was done, it takes faces that are publicly and available and faces of people who are out, and also faces of people, you know, true. when you put your picture online, you're putting like the best like angles, the best version, right? So it's not really taking everyday faces and then like trying to learn it.
Yeah.
So it's taken a very biased data set in many ways, and it's learned this to be like a gay feature. But like, so I agree, like I used to also have that criticism, but there's a lot of people who think that
I think there's a fair point in like getting neutral data sets, but then again it goes back to the journalism thing, is that there's inherent bias in how you collect, how you perceive data, maybe in how you frame the questions that you're putting in your survey. So that is the challenge, the technical challenge, isn't it? It's human fault that's ultimately the problem here.
I think that's where they talk about the stuff of having diverse teams. You know, like someone like Ozzy giving that like very articulated information about how that album gonna come to life, and Ozzy can, if Ozzy was in the room, Ozzy could go, why the fuck are you gonna just focus on celebrities to train to generate data sets on your algorithms? You know, why the fuck should we even do this in the first place? Like, you know, especially when you understand that sociality is a spectrum and it isn't by physical features. Right. That's a very personal experience to the individual, and like, but the way, I think that's obviously a technology thing of we, you know, let's try to solve the solution, let's make it fun and gimmicky. But I think for me it has particular problems, and I don't really see that as a positive human interaction as such. But I think it is we are flawed as humans. I always say that the internet's a repository of evil. Because that's
that is such a great line. It's like,
the internet is a repository. Have you seen my Twitter feed? Is that what you're saying?
No.
Can we put that on a t-shirt, please?
The internet is a repository of evil. Man, that's our merch stump.
Yeah,
cool.
I want that on a t-shirt tomorrow.
So we are always going to be necessarily flawed, and I think it goes back to like it goes back to like Facebook and social, like, but it's like when you think of it, like when, like there was an article that said Facebook, like the, you know, unfortunate incident that happened in Christchurch, New Zealand, and how like some of you were on Aqua about how Facebook is designed for, there was like a, you know, a very upsetting video that was shared on the internet, but it's like Facebook is designed to share. That's its whole purpose as a platform. And design world, UX design world, it's like they have people like personas. Oh, you know, persona is somebody who is in uni and wants to connect with his uni friends or their uni friends, let's get them to sign up to Facebook. But one of the things that we talked about was we never think about the negative people who might use these platforms and how do we essentially design for those as well. You know, how do you design for these particular type of things? But you know, when you're not thinking about the consequences of everything you're doing, you know, this type of stuff. So it does kind of frustrate me in a way when I, like, especially, you know, that what recently happened and just seeing how, you know, like, yeah, really.
Yeah, how social media can contribute to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that is that the question. It sparks up loads of debates. Is that, should that be advocated? Like I said, if the internet's a repository of evil, internet reflects humanity. You know, the question is, should we, like, I always think about it, do you limit these experiences, or do you, like, what is the ethical debate?
Do you unleash
about, do you, like, what is the ethical debate about?
Yeah, do you, like, facilitate, or do you suppress it?
Like, then is it free speech, or is it acceptable speech? This is the type of conversation I have with my girlfriend a lot. It's like, she's amazing, because she's basically had to listen to me rant about this type of stuff, innit? But I always think about it, it's like, is free speech advocated, or should it be acceptable speech, mob culture, all of these, like,
it's very nuanced, isn't it? And I think, you know, people say, oh, it's a black and white thing, it's free speech or not, but in actuality the world and human civilization isn't a perfect thing, and there isn't a perfect solution. It's conversation that we have as collective society around what is acceptable, but it all feeds back to what you're saying, isn't it? It's all about biases and, you know, inherent flaws of people, and how that filters down into algorithms and how they use. So it's all kind of linked, isn't it, I guess?
Alex, we've been talking about, like, all these biases and tech, all these flawed data sets, and how the internet can, you know, be a repository of evil and that. We talked about, like, that survey in the US used for risk assessment. But what about here in the UK? Is it that much different? Because I know that we've talked before about, you know, the gangs matrix. I was wondering, like, could you explain that a little bit more? Like, what is this thing?
It's a good question, because I think one of the good things maybe in the States is that getting that access to that information was pretty important. But it did start from the investigative journalists who were able to, like, get the information, like get to find out how to, they got the survey, they uploaded it on the internet to get people to be able to access it, and then it triggered this whole academic debate on it. And I think in the UK we haven't been able to have maybe that particular type of access to how these you know, these sort of systems are being used in policing, and also in terms of maybe you know, risk assessment in regards to offending and that particular type of stuff. But you mentioned the gang matrix, and the gang matrix, as Amnesty Amnesty International says, because they've done like a very big campaign on against the gang matrix, is that it was launched by the Met Police in 2012. The gang matrix is a database of suspected gang members in London. Its purpose is to be a risk management tool focused on preventing serious violence. But Amnesty International basically wrote a report about this and how it's unfit for purpose. One of the challenges for me is that I'm interested to know how people are placed into the database.
Mm.
I'm very interested in how information is shared. And I'm also interested in what their sort of real-life impact for these young people who are basically disproportionately represented on it. You know, and one of the things about the sort of gang matrix is that it sort of uses a ranking system of green, amber, or red. So, you know, everybody can imagine what that is without me having to describe that. You know, so that's essentially what the particular type of thing is, you know, and what the gang matrix is, and yeah.
I mean, like, so is it, from an ethics point of view, like having something like that, so this I guess algorithm hidden, this black box where the input is we don't know what, but the output is a very tangible, like people being watched by the police or people being affected in a multitude of ways that we might not even know about. I mean, is that something that you think is gonna keep going on? Because, you know, you said earlier that you're 6'4"?
I'm 6'4".
Okay, yeah, so 6'2".
Alex is moving mad, isn't it?
But. So this 5'11 guy.
Are you 5'11?
What?
I'm 5'8 and you're not that much taller than me. Shut up.
I was 5'8 and you're 7. Let me.
Toxic
masculinity.
Go to 7,
toxic masculinity. I'm against toxic masculinity, by the way, but I'm reading a book by Bell's Hooks right now, Masculinity. If anybody cares about what I'm showing.
If anyone wants to know what I'm doing in my spare time, yeah. BT dubs.
Yo, how the fuck could you dunk at year 7?
That's dope.
What was
that? I'm very bad at basketball.
Oh, okay, man. Good.
I was, tall for nothing.
Tall for nothing.
You need to reach, you know, high places. Yeah. Always useful.
But, like, in this world where, you know, people who look like you, who can essentially look intimidating, you know, you say that about like bias and that, if someone like face to face can look intimidating on data, in sort of from a data set, can people look intimidating, if that makes sense?
So you know, I think, let's think of it, London has got a heavy surveillance culture. Come on, I think we have the most CCTV network in the world. I don't know how true that is, but I know that I've heard people mention about London and the CCTV network that it has here. I think surveillance culture is a thing. You now have, you know, people who maybe drill music artists who are basically now having to ask the police. Police are basically giving them crime sentences based on, because they performed a certain song and they're being sent into prison. Music is a form of expression. And, you know, these are young black men who are pretty talented, but because they've said this lyric or said this song, they've been sentenced. So we have a control, power dynamics are shifting in a particular type of way. The gang matrix, yeah, I think, you know, everybody here in this room will obviously understand. And like when I think of the gang matrix described like that, it's a database that sort of ranks people. Obviously, it's got parameters.
Mm.
It's got some sort of parameters that it's sort of been, that this individual's being measured by.
Mm.
So it probably measures like family networks. Has people in their family probably gone to prison? Is this person gone to prison? Where do they live? The postcode lottery. Like, I grew up in Peckham, and I always say it all the time. Like, I grew up in Peckham, before Peckham became trendy. And where I live in Peckham, like, many years ago was quite a very, like, interesting area to live in it. Like now it's just, house prices are so expensive that
Peckham levels,
like,
isn't it?
Yeah, you know, like house prices now are so expensive. I'm trying to use the right to buy to get on the ladder because like all people are buying. You know, like, houses are going for like 700k on my road. I'm like, what?
Damn,
that's now. Yeah. But it wasn't like that 10 years ago.
I'm just gonna say one sec. For everyone listening who's based in the UK, like, you know, tax year is coming. Get into an ISA. Get, you know, that help to buy scheme. Like, put your money away. Make your money work for you. All right, the government's doing good things. All right, get some of that cash. Anyway, that's our financial corner done.
That's finance.
Alex wants the government to help him out. That's why he's saying good things.
look, with the amount of stuff we say, like, we have to offset it. Otherwise, the Home Office is coming for me and Oz.
This is Windrush level 2, bro.
Yeah, I can't have them after me. Okay, I've just come back in.
Yeah, yeah. All right, they'll take away my British passport.
Because apparently that's the thing they do now. All right. So.
I just applied for the thing to get into the States.
Oz.
The ESTA. What is it?
Oh, you'll be fine on the ESTA. It's like, when you try to apply for a visa. Good God.
Like, Canada was so easy. Canada did it in 1 second. Like, Canada was like, I applied for the ETA to get to Canada. Canada was like, oh, yeah, perfect. Mm. America's one was like, application pending. Mm. I was like, oh my God. And I thought it was because I mentioned that I had another passport, which was a Nigerian passport. And I thought, I'm a fool. Yeah. Why did I mention this? But one of the most interesting things on that form is that it asks you to put your social media down. An optional thing. And if you don't read that it says optional in bracket, you can put your social media there.
It's terrible.
Wow.
Yeah. You're going to have the fucking US.
Look at your Twitter.
Look at your US. Yeah, Homeland Security. Yeah. Looking at, you know, but that's surveillance culture. But parameters, these are the things. It's, my question is what were you, how are you referencing somebody is green, red, or yellow? And I think one of the challenging things, it was like stuff like, us four here are friends. I might be a friend who...
Yes.
Oh, wait, I've probably been a friend who's taken the wrong path in life.
So was that hypothetical or are we friends?
No, we're friends. Well, I'm going to be friends now. I've been following Ozzy for... We've been following each other on Twitter for a long time now. But I finally met Ozzy in person. So.
Look at that. We're friends now.
That's nice.
Anyway, back to this hypothetical. Yeah,
we can probably see each other.
No one's friends with you, okay? Just, this is my new friend. Step away.
So, just gonna turn your mic off.
But yeah.
Anyway, so we're friends, yeah.
So we're friends. I've unfortunately maybe taken a different path in life. Mm. You know, but we've all grown up in the same area.
Mm.
But you could, from what I've heard, you three could even be on the list because you're friends with me and we live in the same area. But you lot. Wow, I've got a journalist, computational biologist, and a biologist in the room. Why are you lot on a fucking gang matrix? But these are, so it's like, I'm interested in how are they putting people on there and how are they doing this? And I think the database got leaked and then they got, the Met Police got fined or in trouble by the ICO, what's it, Information Commissioner's Office. And I think they wrote some, the thing about this, people or organizations is that they write like this 50-page report on how people do stuff and like do just write a 1-page blog, help us understand type of stuff. I did a Sky News interview like last year around like gender bias and AI, but the journalist who we did that topic was very interested in like predictive algorithms and how especially the gang matrix, and I know that we were trying to get freedom of information requests to like understand these things, the hardest thing to necessarily do. So I know that he's recently done like a documentary on it for Sky News about like the gang matrix and type of stuff. But there are other sort of surveillance or systems that are being used in policing, but this is quite hidden, isn't it? So it is something for us to recognize. You know, we're having the facial recognition software trials happening at particular train stations and things like that.
Oh shit, really?
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at some of the stats around stop and search, for example, right? Stop and search, you're 4 to 5 times more likely to be stopped and searched if you're a black man. That's under section one. You're 20 times more likely to be stopped and searched, like you're saying, at a train station when they do a section 60 order where they stop an area looking for a certain type of people. So that's fucked up.
And how do you two experience this? Sort of, I don't know, Aussie.
Stop and search. Yeah, I've been stopped and searched.
I've never been stopped and searched. That killed the conversation.
you know what we did? Yeah, I was doing this documentary. Yeah, about Stop and Search, and we went to a boxing club in Hackney, and we asked all the people there in the room who were training, who's been Stop and Search. Go to one side. Who hasn't been Stop and Search? Go to one side. I shit you not. All the black people went to one side. All the white and Asian people went to the other side. People who haven't been Stopped and Searched. And that shows you how fucked up the institution is, isn't it?
But I find it really weird because, you know, there's stereotypes in place and I guess there's bias and everything. But, you know, I've been Stopped and Searched. And on a spectrum, I'm a lot lighter. Yeah. And I speak quite eloquent, or not eloquent, but I speak with a different sort of accent when I'm interacting with law enforcement and stuff, you know. And so the idea that someone who sounds like this, like, oh no, that's fine. Oh, you know, what's going on, can still be stopped and searched, and that, like, you can see that there is that real big bias in there in policing.
I think the question is the bias harmful or is it harmless? Is it more the treatment of when people are being stopped and searched? Always Stop and Search a problem, because somebody can argue that Stop and Search, you find somebody who has a knife in them, but if you search on it, doesn't have a knife in them, is it the treatment? Like, because I know for me that I've been stopped and searched a lot of times, but the difference between me and probably my peers was where they would react angrily to being stopped and searched.
Yeah,
I'd be like, oh yeah, hi, how you guys, how are you? Okay, hey, go ahead, you search me. I probably get searched less. I probably get talked away. So it's like, even then, it's like, it's hard, isn't it?
Because it's a complex issue because it's cultural as well.
Yeah, it's cultural, yeah,
and also police as well. So it's a mixture of the two. You're right.
But it is. Remember, the police officer is using their sort of cognitive understanding of the world, and if they're being told that most people are wearing hoodies, I wear hoodies most of the time, I'm obviously gonna always look like a threat. I haven't been stopped and searched in quite a long time. But, like, I know that for me, I didn't want to wear tracksuits out because I was like, oh, I don't want to get stopped and searched, man.
But it's, like, it's similar, isn't it? With, like, I bet you, like, we get stopped at the airport a lot because that happens. Because airports, you get, like, Asian men with beards getting profiled all the time. Yeah. So, like, there, it's, like, guaranteed to the point where I will make a joke about it before going through security. If I'm traveling with someone, being like, prepare for my random selection.
Completely random. Yeah. Absolutely random.
Yeah, yeah.
The key word is the profiling, and this comes back to AI. So when we use algorithms in these type of environments, the purpose of it is to make an automated decision, and it makes an automated decision based on how it profiles you. So it comes back to that whole thing of credit, for example. Can you beat the algorithm to get credit? You two have Aussie Ismail, is that pronounce it? Sahar Patel.
Yeah.
Put that in I remember seeing this thing of, like, there was this whole thing that your insurance was going up if your name was called Mr. Singh and that type of stuff. There's, like, people who were trying to do this experiment, then John Smith in it, but it's like, question, but these are, why is that happening? Has, you know, someone said, oh, somebody called Singh most likely to, like, what? These are making profiles on you. So if you're trying to train this algorithm or training these systems with these parameters that are being designed by police officers or individuals who are necessarily might have a negative perspective of maybe particular communities, these things might come up. But I don't know what these parameters are because I don't have access to it. So I can't.
You can't.
We can speculate, but we obviously
don't know.
Yeah. Don't know. Yeah.
But I think that's really interesting what you're saying about, like, names and saying, like, Mr. Singh and stuff, because, you know, there is that joke that isn't a joke, which is, if you've got this sort of name, if you've got a name like Patel, a name like Ismail, you know, you're not gonna like, your CV will have bias against you and stuff. And they did that comparison against, I think it was, they did the same names, like someone with a name, you know, Patel, or someone with, like, a very, very Western name compared to someone with a name that's more commonly associated with, like, an ethnic minority with the same skills, and the person with a white name got, like, more callbacks and stuff.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And so there is that idea there that, you know, that happens a lot. But I think what Alex is describing there is you've taken that bias and, like, pushed it to a fucking extreme where it's, like, super, super scary because it's become, like, codified inside this algorithm. And once that happens, it's like, I guess it's like, I don't know, a black box that no one looks behind, and then you can't do freedom.
You can't scrutinize.
Yeah. It.
You can't scrutinize it. And the thing is, and you said this before, Alex, it's people take it as gospel. People are like, oh, this algorithm is, you know, been designed to do this. Thusly, I have complete faith in the, you know, the science behind this without even knowing about it.
Like human there, so they think...
That's the understanding. But obviously, as we said, the data sets, the kind of subconscious bias that you place upon that by the creators of the system, that is the problem, isn't it?
I think black box is a cop-out. Yeah. I mean, the black box excuse is a cop-out. And I think we then, if it's a black box, then we shouldn't put anything in the world that's basically saying, it's a black box, we don't know what goes on. Then we shouldn't put it out in the world, innit? We keep it in the lab, keep training, keep finding, keep learning. Okay, we're ready now.
Yeah.
And let's put it out. Like, that's maybe, but that would be my argument, innit? Because it's like, oh, we don't know why Ozzy's on this matrix. You know, it's a black box. Oh. You know, when Ozzy could probably tell you, I reckon why I'm probably on the on this list. But like, you know, so yeah, it's not, yeah.
It's, you need the scrutiny, don't you? Yeah. That's what you need. You need scrutiny.
So what do you think, like, going forward, like finally, going forward with this, do you think we could ever live in a world where we have these systems in place, you know, something that does, not like profiling, but something that does look at people in society and assign them scores or whatever, that isn't inherently biased or can't inherently be gamed and can't inherently perpetuate power structures or biases that are already, it's biases, that are already like in place?
Nah.
Great answer.
Very succinct.
I think like Philip E. Dick explored this in Minority Report when he wrote the book, and the film Minority Report came out in 2002. All right, really interesting.
Thank you, IMDb.
It's really interesting. No, do why? Because in that future, 2002, they felt like Nokia was going to run the world. So a lot of the stuff Nokia signed in there.
Oh,
and
that's,
I'm like,
funny.
It's so funny. Like, so interesting when people do depictions of the, like, even watching Futurama. And that was created in the 90s, but looking at their depiction of the future and how, like, oh yeah, we got this now. But like, just, I'm always interested in when people depict the future at different times. But with that, Minority Report's purpose was, it was, you could predict that this person is going to commit murder. So you're being arrested for premeditating, I probably said this wrong, I'm not sure, but premeditating murder. So, you know, I'm going to murder someone, and then all of a sudden people break through, hey, get arrested. And in the story, there was no murders for a long time. However, there was this one person that was like, nah, this thing is flawed. I don't believe in it. But I think it got gamed. The system got gamed. And so you could game the system. And the person who gamed the system was the person who was a big advocate for this software or system to thrive and be used. But he gamed the system because he killed someone. But like...
It reflects on what we're talking about, isn't it? Yeah.
So anyway. I personally, no. The internet is a repository of evil, isn't it? Like,
Alex, I saw from your Twitter, this is really weird saying Alex because I feel like I'm referring to myself in third person. But anyway, I saw on your Twitter and sort of various other places that you did this like Alexa simulation, like interaction, using it to, was it order jerk chicken?
Yeah.
So while that output is very, very interesting, like, why did you do that and how did you do it?
So I was working on a project at the time around how do we build a feminist AI bot. And that was inspired by the team behind the Feminist Internet, which is, initially started off as a research project. Now it's an actual organization that is trying to create a feminist internet. But at the time, I was playing around with, like, I was having to teach 40 students who have no programming experience, no coding experience, and how they could necessarily, like, build a feminist AI bot.
Was that University Arts London?
Yeah. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to make something. And what I was actually trying to do at the time was, it was more of a provocative sort of, where people laughed and be entertained by it.
people really engaged with it. People were like, nah, this is not how the bot should speak. It should say this, it should say that. But what I was actually trying to do was this provocative argument about, you know, if you think of, like, voiceless technology doesn't understand accents. There's now, you have your interview voice, but you now have your speaking to Alexa voice. And it was more, can a voice bot understand an accent? And also, can a voice bot be able to speak in an accent as well? Could it be a more natural feeling if you went into a Caribbean restaurant and it was able to speak in Patois or have that sort of thing? And what do we need to do there? So it was a very, like, me being very provocative, but also being very entertaining as well. I wanted to spend more time exploring voice technology, but it is pretty expensive to, like, engineer voice. And so, yeah.
I mean, with the sort of voice work and stuff like that, where do you think it's sort of going? Where do you want it to go? How do you see it?
Well, I'd be interested if it could basically have this Iron Man Jarvis relationship.
Yeah.
That will obviously be the pinnacle. That's actually, I think that is the pinnacle of it. It's really having that sentient relationship with a robot. Like, I was watching, I finally watched Solo, Star Wars Story yesterday. And
what did you think?
My girlfriend found it good. I found it all right. I preferred the other Rogue One. Yeah, that was the best one.
I know. It's like Saving Private Ryan with thermal detonators. I love it.
And everybody dies in it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I love. Not everyone needs to win. Yeah. Just, you know, let them die.
Yeah, so that was nice that everyone died.
Anyway, back to what we were actually
what was I saying? Oh, damn, that's much beautiful. But yeah. But I remember watching Solo, and there was a time when the robot dies, and then I think Donald Glover,
how Donald, fucking dare Jesus. You? Wow, how dare you?
You know,
that's sacred. No, fuck you, leave.
You know, I actually always get it wrong. You know,
really?
Yeah, I know Danny Glover's the much more older.
Yeah,
and then Donald. Thank God. I was going to say Childish Gambino, but I decided not to say Childish.
Say Childish Gambino.
Childish Gambino.
Man, I'm seeing him this Saturday, Sunday. It's going to be sick, man.
Cool. And then Childish Gambino, like, when the robot died, proper was so... That experience was emotional. And it was really interesting to see that relationship of... he's an alien, so he's not a human. But just to see somebody who has humanoid features, have this sort of...
Reaction
to this metallic being.
Yeah.
And so, and I think that's probably where we're trying to get to. You know, the social robot industry is young and still haven't found value propositions yet, and hardware is still very expensive. But I think that's obviously the goal. I'm excited for that type of goal, though, to be honest.
You think it's going to happen, that humanization?
I think it has its benefits.
Yeah.
And it might have its negatives as well, but I think it has its benefits. I just don't want it to be this master-slave
relationship,
which kind of is kind of very reflective in the Western world and master slave. And I think, can it be more of a sort of collaborative relationship rather than master and slave? So that's kind of what I'm interested in. I think if anybody's interested in a lot of our work that we're doing around AI and, like, automated decisions, we just recently did a project about how the young people understand automated decisions and getting them to, and looking at how we could build tech or design tech in a way where young people can understand that. That's on the Comuzi website, Comuzi. If you just type that into Google, Comuzi website will come up. But if anybody's really interested, that was where we took a lot of these learnings and tangible stuff and tried to put that in a real world perspective, if anybody's really interested. So I only have Twitter, so FXFEGHA.
Yeah.
That's my Twitter.
So we've come to the end of the podcast. Oz, Sahel, have you enjoyed? Have you learned something new?
I mean, I certainly have, but I'm still questioning the future of AI and, like, how it's ever going to help us, really.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's such an interlinked thing and it's so difficult to wrap your head around it. I mean, there's still a lot of stuff to be uncovered around this topic, I think.
And Alex, have you enjoyed your time with us today?
Yeah, I wish we spent more time. I hope we spend more time outside of this just talking, having being able to be around a journalist, biologist, and
me. I guess you're
just an entity in your cell.
Oh, technically, I'm a computational biologist, so the best
of both worlds. Just in existence at this point.
And having that conversation. I think for me, I do cherish these type of conversations. I think it was really good.
You hear that? Cherish. Yeah.
One listener is going to enjoy that so much.
This is one slither of goodness in the suppository of evil.
Repository of evil.
What did I say? I said suppository. This is a suppository of good in a depository.
I don't know how you think people like take podcasts, but I don't want to see. Do you not have an app anyway?
Don't ask. Don't go down. No.
This has been Why Aren't You a Doctor Yet? We'll see you next time. Bye.
Why would you pick a song where we have to harmonize? No, pick something easier.
I want you back. I want you back. I want you back.
No.
What are you saying?
Go back to the original song that you were singing. What were you singing before?
What were we singing before? I forget.
Singing my life with his words.
Two time.
Killing me softly with this song. Killing me softly with this song. Telling my whole life with his words. Killing me softly with this song.